The first thing we're going to do is kick it off with a few housekeeping items. And the first one is you've joined the audio today using your computer speaker system, meaning voice over IP. So if you can hear audio through your computer speakers like music, you'll be able to hear our presentation. And you've also joined us muted by default. So what I'm going to do is give you ways that you can interact with us today. It is designed to be interactive so that you can submit questions to our analysts, and we will take a longer Q&A session at the end of today's presentation. So in the upper right corner of your own control panel, I took a screenshot here, you should see something that looks like this. And that's the GoToWebinar user interface. And you can select your audio. So by default, you've joined using VoIP, but if you'd like to call in, you can select Use Telephone in your audio pane. And you can also submit questions to us by submitting your question and clicking Send in your Questions pane. Again, we're going to take a longer Q&A session at the end of today's presentation, so be sure to submit your questions and we'll get to as many as we can. Also, if you would like a copy of today's presentation or would like to hear it again, we will make that available, so we'll be giving you instructions on how you can get copies of both throughout the presentation or at the end as well. With that, I'm going to kick it over to Jack, and he's going to be your host and introduce us to our first presenter.
Terrific. Thank you. Hi, my name's Jack Mazza, and I'm with the End User Programs team here at Gartner. And on behalf of Gartner and Research Vice President Alexa Bona, I'd like to welcome you to our weekly webinar series. A little bit about what we're going to cover today. In the next hour or so, Alexa will be covering a topic that has become just so critical, so important for our clients over the past few months. Probably no surprise to everybody on the call. This is around negotiating the right terms and conditions to contain cost in software licensing and pricing. So Alexa is going to dig into it and provide high-level guidance for you and some specific examples from the Gartner research on cost optimization. I'll make a few introductory comments and then hand it over to Alexa, and she'll walk you through the presentation. Just a little bit about Gartner. Gartner is the world's leading provider of IT research and advisory. We deliver the technology-related insight to help our clients make better decisions each and every day. I mean, that's our bread and butter. That's what we do. Gartner helps our clients cut costs wisely, and that's critical. And that's done in a variety of ways, one of which is through research relationships that give you direct access to over 650 research analysts. During the next hour, you will hear references to our most successful product, and that's called Gartner for IT Leaders. Just want to make you a little bit familiar with that. Gartner for IT Leader features the most critical research and information relevant to your role. That is what you folks do. Alexa's specific recommendations for software negotiations are derived from our analysts' daily experience with IT Leaders clients, who are just like you. They review over 1,000 contracts each year. So lots and lots of contracts, lots of fact base, and you know, really directed at finding hard dollar savings in roughly 75% of them. So with strategic vendors, we typically find savings in and around $100,000 per contract. Alexa's presentation will help you form an idea on how Gartner can guide you and your organization to higher levels of success. So with that, I'll be turning the meeting over to Research Vice President Alexa Bona. Alexa?
Hi, thank you very much, Jack. Welcome, everybody. As Jack said, my name's Alexa Bona, and I'm a Vice President in our IT Asset Management and Procurement area. I cover trends in software licensing and pricing and maintenance and support. I look at a high level at trends in buyer-supplier dynamics in the software market, new delivery models for software like software as a service, but more pragmatically, I also help clients who are negotiating deals with major strategic vendors like Microsoft and Oracle, SAP, and increasingly some of the software as a service vendors like Salesforce.com and so forth. As Jack said, I'm getting a lot of calls right now from Gartner for IT Leaders clients, because the economic downturn has resulted in significant pressure on IT budgets. We're really seeing that discretionary spend is falling off significantly and mandatory spend is being really heavily scrutinized. And software contracts and the fees associated with them really come under the spotlight because they often represent a really large line item in budgets for our clients. As we're going to see, software fees are fairly difficult to reduce without having negotiated the right kinds of flexibilities. So in this presentation, we're going to look at some of the key ways that we at Gartner help our clients to reduce costs. Before I get into the detail, though, I just wanted to set the scene for the high-level dynamics that are at play in the software market, and that's the slide that we're looking at here. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page and to help everyone understand why, in many ways, the software market is unique in terms of buyer-supplier dynamics. The first thing that is unique is that you don't really have any ownership of anything. You just have rights to use that are very specific, that are often actually changing as you go. Many of you who have licensed software with vendors like Microsoft will know that they are actually changing. You will also find that there is, in the software market, very low competition after the initial buy. If we build out the slide here, you see that's because there is essentially very high switching costs. Switching costs are going to be prohibitive for most organizations. It's not the cost of the software from the competitor that's the problem. It's the amount of money that you spend on ancillary services. So with software, what happens is you not only spend the money on the licenses, but then you start to spend additional money implementing the software with a systems integrator. You then spend another pile of money spending money integrating the software with other applications. Then you spend money on testing, on training, on hiring an army of support people to support the application for you, and then finally upgrading the application to the next better version a few years later. So by the time you spent all the money on those ancillary services, normally you spent somewhere between 3 and 7 times license fees doing that additional work. And so if you wanted to switch to an alternative provider, it would be incredibly expensive. Your software vendor would effectively have to put up their fees by 300% to 700% in order for you to economically justify a switch. So you see in this chart, you move very fast in software from the left-hand side to the right-hand side of the chart. It's, you know, if you look at the left-hand side, that will be buying pencils. You know, if you bought pencils and your provider put the pencil price up, you could just move to another pencil supplier. But if you're looking at something like SAP licenses, that's just not the case. And this is compounded by the fact that there is no secondary market for software. Again, if you bought something in another market, let's say you bought an aeroplane by mistake, it's a pretty expensive mistake, but you could at least sell off the parts in a secondary market to make some of the money back. If you bought too many Oracle ERP licenses, nothing much you can do about that because they are only licensed for you, your enterprise. Nowhere else for you to sell those. Again, the situation is also compounded by the fact that maintenance is in most cases single source. The vendor owns the source code. And so it is almost a quasi-monopoly on support. If you go to your vendor and say to them, I'm sorry, I don't like the maintenance fees. I think we should reduce them. I don't want to pay 22%. I think I should be paying more like 18%. They're going to say, fine, that's great. Go somewhere else then. And you say, well, I can't go anywhere else. And they say, that's right, pay 22%. We are seeing a market emerging now for third-party support for certain applications. We are seeing some vendors that some companies that do offer this, but it's still a fairly small market, and for most vendors, maintenance is still single source. And finally, confidentiality clauses in many agreements mean that organizations can't really talk to one another about deals without breaching the agreement, so that organizations never really know whether what is happening is unique to them or affecting everybody in the marketplace. So what we can do at Gartner, at least to help some of this, is that we can at least generically give you some information about what is happening in the marketplace to help your situation. But the main point here is that it's incredibly difficult in software after you've done the initial deal. And the initial deal is normal competition. the vendors are all looking for your business, but after you've done that initial deal, because of these dynamics, the power switches very dramatically into the arms of the vendors. And even when I talk to very large companies, big name companies who you would normally think would be calling the shots in buyer supplier relations, they are, in many cases, feel very beholden to their software vendors. So I don't want to depress you here, but I just want to be very clear to establish up front why the terms and conditions in the license agreements are so vital, why it's not just boring legalese. So with that, let's move to one of the polling questions. I wanted to actually, before we go any further, do a quick poll. We do get a lot of questions from clients who are desperately trying to reduce their software costs, but who are struggling with the contracts in many cases. And so with that in mind, I really wanted to ask you this initial question. So among your, I just opened the poll, 1 second. So the question is, among your software vendors, how many offer licensing flexibilities to reduce fees as a result of the economic downturn? And so I really, what I wanted you to do is to answer either none, or one, or 2 to 4, or maybe you're finding all of your vendors are offering you some flexibility here. As I said, we're seeing significant evidence at Gartner that organizations are struggling in this regard, so I would be interested to see if organizations are having some ability to, let's say, downsize their contracts, even temporarily. It doesn't necessarily have to be a permanent downsizing, but you might find that they're willing to accommodate perhaps a temporary downsizing. We certainly can talk a little bit in subsequent slides about what terms and conditions you might need to make that possible. But let's have a look and see where we've got to. So if I just close the poll and share the results with you, what we've got here is 61%, the majority, saying none of the vendors are helping them, which is fairly consistent with what we see. But interestingly, I see that 20% say that 2 to 4 have seen some flexibility, which is encouraging. Again, some of this will depend on how good your original contracts were, and some of it will depend on which vendors you're dealing with. But thank you very much for responding to that poll. We'll be doing another couple of polls later. But let me get into some of the ways that you might be able to achieve some of these flexibilities. So if we look at the key issues in the presentation, firstly, how can your organizations reduce their costs and risks in software deals? Let's have a look at that key issue. I wanted to start with maintenance, as with the economic downturn, there is significant pressure on IT budgets, resulting in a decrease in overall software transaction volumes. So we're just not seeing as many deals as we would normally see. And of course, the deal sizes are often much lower as well. And what that's resulted in is that if the vendors who are struggling to make their projected numbers with new license revenue, they're increasingly reliant on the maintenance for the annuity revenue piece. So vendors are very interested in this maintenance piece. And meanwhile, on the other side of the fence, for clients, maintenance is a significant line item in their budget, and despite trying to reduce it, many feel instinctively that their costs should be going down. Why should their costs be going down? Because the version that they're on, they feel, is not new, it's relatively stable, they're not making very many calls to the help desk, they're doing quite a lot of self-support because they have a lot of people now who are very experienced, who know how the application works. And also, the vendor, in some cases, is doing more of their support offshore, so they feel that the fee should really be going down. However, the reality is, as we just discussed, for many vendors, maintenance is a quasi-monopoly. So costs are really defined by the market, not by the actual costs. And I'm afraid to say, the general trend is that maintenance fees are going up. The average that we see in the marketplace is about 18 to 22% of the net license fees. Some of you may have experienced fairly recently, for example, a big vendor like SAP announcing an increase in fees from 17 to 22%. Although for the existing customers, they're ramping that, so it's only 8% each year for the next 5 years, but in reality, that five percentage points, whilst it sounds quite small, 5 points, it's actually a 29% net increase in fees over the 5 years. Now, we've written quite extensively on how SAP customers can deal with this and strategies for them to be able to contain the costs, but there are some general issues that would apply to all organizations who are looking at maintenance concerns. And the first thing I think I'm going to point out is maintenance caps. In your initial deal, it's very critical to make sure that you've negotiated some kind of a maintenance cap. This would be something that suggests that you would get no increase in maintenance fees for the first 3 to 5 years, and then a maximum of consumer price index or retail price index or whatever your index is that you prefer. That way, you can protect from significant increases in fees above and beyond that. So those customers, for example, with SAP, who did have those negotiated in their contracts, are not paying the additional 8% if they've got, for example, no increase and they're still in that period. I would also recommend documenting your entitlements. One of the other things that I often see in contracts is that there is a statement in the maintenance clause that says you will be entitled to our maintenance policies as defined in our current price list or as defined in our current policy, and then there might be a website link to the current policy. That effectively would allow the vendors to change their policies when they want, and increasingly we're seeing that many of them are diminishing the entitlements. So you might find that something that you thought you had got included in your rate has now been put into a higher priced maintenance offering, and you would have to upgrade in order to get it. So make sure that you have documented all the things that you're getting in maintenance, service level agreements, support periods, this kind of thing, and include clauses that say this cannot diminish for the period of the time I am paying maintenance. Perhaps the most critical one here, though, in this period of downturn is a right to terminate or temporarily suspend, park maintenance on part of the portfolio. Now, this is critical because, and as you would expect, in the downturn, many clients are calling saying they've got less licenses, or people have been laid off, or maybe you've just got better at monitoring usage and you realize that this is a good way to reduce costs would be not to pay for licenses you're not using. But when they come to the agreement, if you haven't negotiated it, many vendors' standard agreements, they state that maintenance is an all or nothing proposal. So partial termination on the subset of the licenses is impossible. Or if they do let you terminate licenses on a subset of the licenses, then you may end up paying additional fees. One big vendor, Oracle, for example, would require that they will say if you want to cancel maintenance on a subset, they have the right to reprice all of your remaining licenses at the then current discount that they see fit. And in many cases, that's a lot lower than the discount you'd have got on your original licenses, making the termination of maintenance economically not so attractive. So even if you manage to manage terminating the maintenance, the other thing that you need to look at is the reinstatement fees. We'll talk a bit about this later, but in many cases, vendors will also charge you back maintenance fees if you want to reinstate maintenance at a later point. So this is another thing to avoid. Related to maintenance, one of the major maintenance entitlements is, of course, rights to new versions of software, which is why many clients we speak to are extremely frustrated when they feel they've paid maintenance and the new functionality that they were expecting turns out to be a new product. So some clients have explained to me that the reason for the graphic is some clients explained to me they felt it was a bit like a shell game. You know those games that you get at fairgrounds where you have to guess where the ball is, and there's a lot of movement of the balls, and invariably it's not where you thought it was. You thought it might have been a maintenance entitlement, but it turns out to be a functional upgrade or a new product. So there are many examples of this, but let me just use one from Microsoft. as I suspect many of you are using their products. For a number of years, Microsoft licensed something they called a Core Cow to access a number of the back office server products. The client access licenses for SharePoint, System Center Configuration Manager, which used to be SMS, Exchange, and Windows were included in this Core Cow. And many clients licensed this through an enterprise agreement with Microsoft. But in late 2006, early 2007, Microsoft introduced a new bundle called the Enterprise Cow. And what they did here was to take the enhancements to products like Exchange and SharePoint, and rather than offer them as maintenance or what Microsoft calls software assurance, they called them a new license bundle, which required a step-up fee, an additional fee for every license. So how could you avoid this? Many clients are saying, why did I pay software assurance if I didn't get the upgrade? Well, one of the problems that we see in contracts is that many people still have contracts that just license a product name. What we recommend is that organizations would include a generic definition of the functionality licensed as well as the product name. So rather than licensing something like Microsoft Office or Microsoft Office Pro Plus, what you would want is to say we've got a productivity tool which does word processing, does spreadsheeting, does emailing, does calendaring, scheduling, etc. And if you start to do a generic definition of those within the contract and then put a clause that says if this functionality is subsequently renamed or rebundled or repackaged or relicensed, and it's the same as the what we've described here, or if we pay maintenance substantially similar to what we've described here, then we're not going to pay anything extra. Certainly Microsoft customers that I've spoken to who did have those clauses in their contracts avoided paying the step-up fee for their enterprise cow. That saved one client I spoke to recently about $750,000 on their Microsoft contract. Now, this isn't just Microsoft. I've given you Microsoft an example. I could have picked many other vendors. It's particularly a problem when you're buying big suites of products with many different functionalities in. So be aware of that and try to include some generic definitions and functional rebundling clauses. Another area where we see problems in software terms and conditions is very basic, but it's often overlooked. And that's about defining metrics or models or mechanisms that would be used to define how you pay for the software. So many organizations will think they've got this covered. They say, oh, yeah, we've got a contract based on named users. We've got a contract based on CPUs. We know how that is, Alexa. We're very clear about that. But when we get into the detail with them, we've discovered that in many cases there are ambiguities in the definition or, in fact, very unintuitive definitions which have led to expensive disputes and audits. Let me give you an example here, this time from Oracle. Many customers have got named user licenses with Oracle for the database. And I've spoken to a lot of organizations who say, yep, that's simple. I'm just counting the users who are sitting at their desk tip-tapping into the Oracle database. But when they read the definition carefully, they realize that Oracle's definition of named user actually includes non-human devices that are interacting with the Oracle database as well. So they would now have to count things like electricity meter reading devices or temperature monitoring devices. Or in one case, I remember one government organization was having to pay for every bomb on every aircraft with an Oracle license. Very, very expensive. So first thing here is you need to be very clear upfront about what the definition is and use examples in your contract to avoid surprises. If that client, those clients had realized they were counting all of these things in advance, they would not have picked a named user model. They'd have picked something else. So the message here is make sure that you're 100% clear with examples on how you're actually paying for the software because that's often not as clear as you might have imagined. As you'll see later with our slide on virtualization, any kind of CPU or capacity-based model is also rife with concern. Now, avoiding paying for more than you are using. This is related to the license definitions, and it's the thorny issue of license minimums. Many customers that I speak to, clients I speak to, overlook this, or they're unaware of it. but a number of major vendors do have minimum license requirements embedded into their contracts. And if you're not careful, this means that you are actually going to be having to license more than you're actually using. To pick up on that Oracle example I was using before, let's say I did license by named user. Oracle actually has minimums which require 25 named users for every processor. Now, not only is that problematic in test and development environments where you may have many less than that, but as Oracle defines a processor as a core, it means that when you upgrade server to, let's say, a 4-core or an 8-core server, even if you have exactly the same number of users that you had before, you're going to need to pay more because you've got more processors by their definition. It's not just Oracle, by the way. There are other vendors that do this. If you've got an SAP Business Suite license, you need to license 25% of your total employees. And in a level of detail below that, if you're licensing the useful lower price limited professional category for more casual usage scenarios, often it states that that can only be a maximum of 15% of the higher price professional users. Again, it may lead to situations where you're buying expensive category licenses that you just don't need in order to get the less expensive ones that you do. So, recommendation here, understand if the vendor does have minimums and eliminate them. In my view, minimums are for small organizations who are barely meeting a threshold for discounting. They are not for large companies, and software vendors should not be actively promoting shelfware. If you can't actually eliminate them, then try to reduce them so that they more realistically fit what your usage scenario might be. Now, let's take a moment to look at audits. This is a clause that's becoming increasingly important. Actually, at this point, I'll also open up another poll. One second. I was just going to ask you a question on audits. At this point, again, I'd be appreciative if you could address the polling question, which is, has your organization been approached by a software vendor to do a software audit in the last 12 months? So this is just a yes or no answer. Any vendor, the audit could be on-site. It could be that they're requiring you to do an off-site audit through an audit tool. It could be that they're bringing on a third-party consultant. It could be a third-party organization like a SPA, Software Publishers Association, or Business Software Alliance kind of organization. So any kind of audit at all, I'm interested just to see if you've done that or not. So let's see. Let's close the poll and share the results with you. So yeah, that's 65% of you have said, yes, you have been asked to do an audit in the last 12 months. That's actually fairly consistent with what we were seeing at our last IT Asset Management conference. We're seeing an increase in audit. Prior to this, when we did our annual surveys about audits for the last 2 or 3 years, we were normally seeing about 35 or 40% of organizations who were getting audited by at least one software vendor a year. But our last IT Asset Management conference in November, that actually went up, and that's fairly consistent with what you're seeing here, so 65%. It's a fairly high number. Now, as I said, we're seeing a lot more of this activity. Some vendors, like IBM, have declared that they're auditing all of their mainframe customers and are now ramping up with a similar mandate for the distributed customers. But we're also seeing, through client inquiry, increased audits from vendors like Adobe, Attachmate, Microsoft, Oracle, including all of the companies that Oracle acquired, like BEA. Quest is another one that we see, and really just starting this year, more from SAP. Now, in some cases, these audits are entirely legitimate. There are some customers who've completely lost control of compliance. In other cases, though, let me just go back to the original audit slide. Excuse me. In other cases, we've seen that audits may be more related to a downturn and a shortfall in license revenues. We've certainly seen increased incidents of audits and audit notices appearing, for example, after large enterprise agreement deal discussions fell through. Audits are painful and are expensive. Those of you who just responded to that survey are probably very aware of that. Obviously, we recommend holistic and proactive software asset management processes and policies, including in compliance disciplines, and we've got lots of research papers around this, how to avoid audits, how to prepare for audits. But from a pure cost minimization perspective, here are some key terms that you would need to define that are often missing in contracts. So first of all, it's really useful to know what you should be paying if you're found to be out of compliance. Are you paying list prices? Are you paying net prices? We would recommend that you would try to negotiate that you should only pay net prices if you're, let's say, no more than 10% out of compliance and you're prepared to pay within 30 days. It's probably not achievable if you're, say, 50% out of compliance, otherwise there would be little incentive for you to remain compliant. But the other aspect I would definitely recommend you look at is define who's paying the cost of the audit. I spoke to a client a little while back who spent 6 months going through an audit and spent about £500,000 on $500,000 on internal cost. So they were actually in compliance. They weren't out of compliance at all. None of that money was cost of additional licenses required. It was simply the amount of money that they had to pay in order to conduct the audit, finding all the information that was necessary, finding all the reports, knowing what was required and what was not required, what was valid and what was not valid is key here. But certainly make sure that you have defined who pays the cost of the audit. I would argue it should be the vendor because it's actually their cost of doing business. Now, I said before that we talk a little bit about virtualization when I talked about CPU licensing models. The real issue here is virtual IT real pricing headaches. Virtualization comes in many flavors, but it is a thorny issue that's rarely addressed in software contracts, resulting in imagined cost savings being, in some cases, completely wiped out by software costs. So people think when they do virtualization, they're going to save money from hardware, software, network systems management, people costs. But the software savings are rarely there at all if they have not addressed this proactively in the contract. And as I said, the costs can completely wipe out any of the other savings. And that's because many vendors still charge based on maximum potential capacity. Not what you're actually using, but what you could potentially use. So if you had 64 CPUs available, even if you're only using 4, you would pay for 64 on day one. Many vendors do not recognize software partitioning at all. So you might be happily using VMware or another solution, and the software vendor will not recognize that and will require that you pay based on the maximum potential capacity. It's a big topic. We have some research. My colleague Jane Disborough has just written a piece that's related to Oracle in this regard. There are no real industry standards here. There's no real usage-based pricing. We're doing a lot of research in this area right now to help define industry standards, but meanwhile, you need to make sure that you're negotiating individual protections with your individual vendors. So let me switch areas a little bit here and talk a bit about software as a service. We're getting a lot more inquiry about software as a service. There's a lot of clients who are interested in these deal structures as a way of reducing upfront costs, particularly with the downturn. They're seduced by the lower fees that they may be paying initially, and for a certain, maybe shorter period, the total cost of ownership. But the issue here is the contracts are quite different from the traditional on-premise agreements. So I just wanted to take you through some of the highlights of what you might want to watch out for. The first thing is that utility pricing is talked about a lot but not really available. What I mean by that is if you sign up for 100 users, you're going to pay for 100 users irrespective of how many users you actually have using the software and to what degree. Although there's talk about utility, there is actually very little reduction potential. So again, I would try to negotiate some ability to reduce users, particularly if you're signing multi-year deals. I see a lot of people signing 2, 3, sometimes even 4-year deals, but they need to have an ability to actually readjust the numbers midway through the contract. If the vendor is not going to allow you to do that, then don't overcommit. Just commit to what exactly the minimum that you think you may need, and then negotiate volume bands, which would allow you to buy more incrementally at lower prices when you hit the higher volumes. Your discounts might be not quite as high, but you're reducing the risk of what we would call shelfware as a service, which is precisely the problem that software as a service companies are trying to address, in theory at least. We're seeing increasingly aggressive discounting on some of the SaaS deals that we're seeing in markets like CRM. Because this market has become, this delivery model has become more interesting to organizations, there is more competition, particularly as some of the big vendors like Microsoft and Oracle have entered this market in the CRM world at prices below $70 per user per month, which is challenging to some of the more established players like Salesforce.com. But although we're seeing aggressive discounting on the original deal, you need to make sure that you're getting price caps on the renewal. A lot of organizations go into these deals thinking that they're just going to be renewing them at the same price they paid on their original deal or at a better price. But either the price goes up quite significantly, and I've seen examples of it going up 10, 15, 20% on renewal, or in some contracts like Salesforce.com's contracts, the contract says that you will pay list price on renewal, and the renewal is automatic. So again, you need to make sure that you've got a minimum increase on renewal and that recognize that the terms and conditions are important to negotiate, not just the initial start price. There are a lot of unexpected add-on fees that we see in software as a service deals. I've just written a research note going into detail on some of these hidden costs that we can get to. Any of you who are interested, just send us a message. But to give you some highlights, from a storage perspective, many people think that storage would be part of the infrastructure, so should be included in the deal. But many SaaS providers actually limit the amount of storage that you get in your standard agreement. So you might be limited to 20 megabyte per user, or 1 gigabyte per site, or 10 megabyte per user. You need to try to make sure that, if possible, you get all the storage that you need included. I definitely agree with the argument that when you go with software as a service, the infrastructure is the software as a service provider's responsibility. You have outsourced that, so why should you be having to spend your time doing demand management for infrastructure components? If you can't eliminate it or get it as much as you need included, make sure that you've negotiated discounts and you've tried to tie the price to the real cost of storage, because in many cases the incremental fees that you get charged per gig from these software as a service vendors are much higher than you might be paying on the open market. Sandboxing or test and development environments also are an area of concern. They used to be included. Now most vendors seem to charge for those extra. In some cases, Salesforce charges about 20% of the per user fee for the sandbox. NetSuite, about 40,000 to 100,000 per year. Other vendors might include it for free if you're using the sandbox during a scheduled upgrade. Recommendation here is, try to reduce the fees or eliminate the fees if you're just using the sandbox during a scheduled upgrade. Or just try to pay for the users that are doing the sandboxing work rather than paying for all of them. Finally here, let me mention the premium maintenance. Maintenance is included in many of these deals, but we've seen a general diminishment in the level of support that's provided in the basic offering. So in some deals, we see no telephone support at all. You just got email and a knowledge-based search. Or if you do get technical support included, you're just getting it with a two-day response time. One client said to me, I think I bought the right to complain, but not a lot more. So you know, you'll find that if you want things like 24/7 support or specific SLAs on response time, you might expect, you know, in 2 hours or 3 hours, you're going to be charged as much as 15 to even, I've seen up to 37.5% of the monthly user cost for that premium support. So make sure you've clearly understood what you're getting in your support and if that meets your requirements. And again, the termination is an interesting thing to think about. Most people forget about the termination, but exit clauses are really vital. Make sure that you have the right to get your data out at the end within a certain time frame. I've seen deals where customers have had to renew their deal with their SaaS provider because the SaaS provider didn't provide them the data in a timely fashion, and they would not have been able to continue the business unless they renewed the contract. Normally would recommend that you have a, they have to provide you with the data within at least 30 days. Downtime and the SLAs for downtime are also an area which is often overlooked. In some contracts, I see no service level commitments at all for downtime or uptime, let alone any kind of penalties. So for key processes, you're probably expecting something like 99.9% uptime. That's what we would see best in class. However, remember that your SaaS provider is only committing to that for back-end processing. They're excluding any pre-scheduled downtime, and they're also excluding any of the events outside of the back-end processing, so any internet downtime will be excluded from that number as well. Make sure that you've negotiated penalties and escalation clauses. The idea here is that you have something to motivate your provider to meet the service level and to keep the application running smoothly. The idea is not that you can collect a nice lot of fees after a spectacular failure to deliver your mission-critical services. I would generally recommend maybe one day's fees returned for every full or partial percentage point below the SLA that's not been met each month. And maybe you want to also negotiate the right to terminate with a full refund if they miss the SLAs for 2 or 3 months in a row. Give you some additional leverage. In terms of data protection and some additional commercial considerations, most SaaS contracts, they make the end customer responsible for security and data protection and compliance with any local laws. So that's all back in your court. So you need to know what the SaaS provider's privacy policies are. What are their processes for alerting you if there was a breach? If you and your local environment only have 24 hours to notify all your customers if there's been a breach of their data, you need to make sure that you've got enough, you've been told about it enough in advance to have a chance of meeting that. What happens if your SaaS provider's data center is in the US, but you've got users in other jurisdictions? You know, is your provider complying with local laws? I really recommend you get your legal involved early here. I see many SaaS providers signing up to safe harbor agreements for example, Europe, to guarantee compliance with cross-border transfer aspects of the European Data Privacy Directive. And now, that's better than nothing, but many don't find that robust enough in terms of enforcement. So get your legal data privacy experts involved early. And make sure that you... you own the data and you can get the data out without paying any fees if you want to do analysis or backup or you need it for compliance reasons or, you know, obviously if the deal's terminated. So we're saying before, you need to make sure that you've got the right to get to those data. So finally, let's just look at some of the classic gotchas. I often talk to clients about deals, and their main focus initially is about the price and the discount. So we chat a little bit about that, and then after that, I usually suggest we spend some time looking at the terms and conditions to make sure that they're up to scratch. And as I said, the terms and conditions, as we've seen in many cases, are include huge amounts of financial concern. And clients are sometimes dismissive, and they say, oh, you know, we've got that handled by legal. Don't have to worry about that, Alexa. And whilst I absolutely agree you need legal involvement, there are some classic commercial protections that legal sometimes misses. And so these examples I'm just going to give you quickly here are from clients' contracts that I've helped them with when they agreed that it was worthwhile to do, when we had a look at the terms and conditions. So I had a look at this one contract, and I said to them, okay, so if you saw this clause in your contract, would you like it? If the licensee decided to change from one supported database to another supported database, the cost for doing this will be horrendous. They said, oh, no, no, Alexa, we don't want that. We haven't got that. And I said, no, what you've got is this, database colon Oracle, or whatever the database was in that case. That means in this case that you can only use the Oracle database. If you wanted to transfer to something else, there would be additional fees, and I knew that vendor did charge additional. So recommendation I would have made is the licensee may transfer the software at no additional cost to any hardware platform, software operating system, or database that the vendor supports for this software. Another one. If you drop maintenance but want to restart it after a year, you're subject to whatever we want to charge at the time, and you will have absolutely no leverage. Would you like that? So what you've got here is, in the event that maintenance is declined for some period of time and subsequently requested or reinstated, the vendor will invoice the licensee the accrued maintenance fees associated with such time period plus a reinstatement fee. Note that that reinstatement fee is undefined and could be anything. It could be almost as much as the total license fees. That came from a major vendor's software contract. So what we recommend is, of course, that you can resume maintenance for lapsed periods by paying no more than what you would have been paying had you been current. Now, you might argue we should be paid less than that because we didn't get any support during that period, which I would agree with, but in reality, I don't really see much less than 75% of what should have been paid. Finally, we're going to send you software that you're not licensed to use. If you use the software in error, you will be out of compliance with the contract, and woe betide you if we audit. Some vendors actually send you media with all of the software that they produce, irrespective of what you license. And often, although you might have spent months trying to negotiate a contract with specific licensing entitlements, the person who's actually installing the software doesn't know that, and so happily goes and starts deploying or downloading elements that you're not allowed to use. And then subsequently, you find yourself with an audit letter. So recommendation of what you should get is the licensor shall not ship any software to license that the licensee is not authorized to use. So to close with some recommendations, I'm not going to go through all of these. We've talked about a number of them already. One final thing I'll leave you with, though, is the last one, which is checking your invoices. It's not a term and condition. It's just something that you can go about doing now, and a good way to for some organizations to save quite a lot of money. Why is that? It's because in the IT industry, we believe that 65% of invoices are actually inaccurate. You might be thinking to yourself, no, that can't be true. Well, when I do these presentations at conferences and I ask people, how many of you have signed the standard vendor's terms and conditions, no changes, just the actual boilerplate agreement? When I ask for show of hands, that's no hands. So everybody signs individual agreements. So imagine that everybody on this call has got a slightly different agreement with the major suppliers than everyone else. Do you think that all of those software vendors' billing systems are so sophisticated that they actually can capture all of the unique invoices and all of the unique terms and conditions? The answer to that is generally no. So you tend to get some version of the standard invoice. So although your procurement people may have spent 9 months negotiating for customized agreements with consulting credits, maybe with a ramp on maintenance, so you weren't paying maintenance initially for the first, 3 months, 6 months, a year. You may have various other entitlements embedded in the agreement. Very likely your invoice won't reflect that. So I've seen organizations one organization I spoke to saved 1% of their entire IT budget by just going back and doing a very simple invoice reconciliation exercise and looking to see what should we have paid versus what did we pay or what are we being billed for. So invoice reconciliation is probably a great one to end on for some practical cost containment advice. So with that, let me switch back to Jack to close out the presentation.
Alexa, thank you very much. That was very insightful, and you know what a critical topic, especially in light of the current economic environment. If we look at the slide 22, Gartner reduces IT costs in different ways. This just outlines the four distinct ways that Gartner can take costs out of IT. For those of you that are clients, be sure to engage our analyst, your account executive. We're just ensuring that you get the most resources. You're aware of the resources that are available to you today. For those of you who are considering a relationship with Gartner, you should know that these experts will, and if you look at the right side of the slide, it just maps it out. It's the best pricing and terms, looking at opportunities to reduce IT costs, how you implement the savings, and then restructuring or improve processes. All four of those are key milestones in how we cut costs, how we manage costs, and make sure we're doing it in a very prudent way. If you're looking for more detail around that, you can see at the bottom of the page, we have the actual link, gartner.com/economy, to see exactly what we're talking about there. And I know many of you have visited that before, but that's just a reference for those of you who haven't had the opportunity to do that. If we go to the next slide, slide 23, first and foremost, we want to thank everybody on the call for participating, and we do have a couple of questions, but we wanted to direct any requests to the appropriate resources. So specifically, follow up with your Gartner account executive if you have additional questions, comments, or requests. If you need help on who that is, just email us at GartnerWebinars@Gartner.com. And then, of course, we've had a couple of requests for a copy of the presentation. Please just contact your account executive or the Gartner Webinars email. Either way, we will make sure we get that to you. So with that, we've got a couple of minutes left. I'd like to jump over to a couple of questions. Specifically, why don't I just jump right into it? Alexa, this relates to the first part, or the focus on the maintenance. Mm-hmm. And it's specifically around, does it start on day one, or is there any chance we could get contracts where the maintenance fees are ramped up in line with the deployment of the technology or the deployment of the software?
Okay. Usually the standard is that they start on day one. However, in the current economic environment particularly, I've seen most vendors, if it was a new deal, being very willing to consider ramps in maintenance so that you maybe pay, say, a third of the maintenance in the first year, another third in the second year, and the final 100% in the third year. Or it's actually mapped to milestones within your own deployment. And in some cases, you know, I've even seen license fees as well as maintenance mapped in that respect. So it depends on how big the deal is and how much the vendor wants it. But I've definitely seen more willingness to do that in recent months than I have seen historically. If you don't negotiate anything, you're paying based on day one.
Terrific. Now, back to the Microsoft example. One of the mm-hmm. questions, or actually is a comment, said this is a great idea. But how many of Microsoft's customers really get this type of clause?
Ah, yes. I mean, I've seen it enough times to be able to say it on a briefing like that. So if the rules we have at Gartner is, you know, if we only see this a handful of times, we're not going to talk to anyone publicly about it for confidentiality reasons. I mean, Microsoft would be able to trace that back to individual accounts, and all the conversations we have with our clients are confidential. So if I'm going to be talking about these kind of recommendations, we generally will have seen them, you know, 20 times, 30 times, 40 times. In the case of Microsoft, it's not easy. I'm not going to suggest it's easy. It's because Microsoft is very well aware of the fact that it inhibits their ability to increase license revenue over time. But I have seen it being achieved. Now, the level of granularity of the definitions has been variable. But certainly I have seen organizations who have managed to get at least some generic description of the functionality included in their contracts. Yes.
Thank you. Now, shifting gears a little bit on a strategy for maintenance, and specifically, have you seen cost savings in a time and materials type contract versus, for an organization that's moving off of maintenance?
If this is related to kind of a third-party maintenance offering, so I'm assuming that that's what the question is directed at. There are organizations out there who will either offer maintenance and support services at half the price of what was being paid before to your existing vendor. So that would be companies like Rimini Street or Conexus or Versatech or Crete Cedar Creestone. Or there are companies that would do maintenance on a time and materials basis for major software vendors as well. We haven't seen huge swathes of companies who've moved to this third-party model, but we're definitely getting more requests for information about it. And certainly those that we've spoken to have engaged in those models have said that they have saved money. Now, they're usually obviously companies who are not planning to move to any new version of that vendor software in the next 3, 4, or 5 years, because those third-party maintenance models do not provide you with new versions. But if your scenario is one where you don't think you're going to be moving to newer versions, you're just staying on the version that you're interested in, then yes, the companies that we spoke to in general have saved money by moving to third-party maintenance models and have not come across, I haven't come across any that have called us at least yet that have come up against issues that could not be solved by the third-party support provider.
Terrific.
If you're interested in a bit more detail on that, we have research pieces about third-party maintenance models written by Pat Phelan and Bobby Gu that might help you.
Great. Now, one quick one, Alexa, because I know we're running out of time. What do you mean by sandboxing?
Okay, the sandboxing is the test and development environment that is provided to you by the software as a service provider. So this enables you to check what impact, for example, the new versions technologies would have on your existing processes before you actually kind of they flipped the button and you went live with them.
Terrific.
Many organizations will use those to before they do the major upgrades.
Well, let me start off by thanking you, Alexa, for the, for again sharing your insight and the recommendations. And last but not least, thank everyone again on the phone for participating. We hope that you found this very valuable. If you are looking for the content, if you are looking for copies of the slides, again, I direct you back to your Gartner account executive or send an email to GartnerWebinars@Gartner.com. Thanks again, and have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.